Radio, your gamer's role.
www.d20radio.com.
Broadcast live, you're listening to the Order 66 podcast, brought to you by Gamer Nation Studios, D20 Radio, and the generous donations of Jared Williams, Kevin Malone, Donald Weller, Sean Kumar, Darren Hampton, Andy Bethel, B. Witzel, and Balaam's Blasters.
What is up, Gamer Nation? GM Chris here, and for those tuning in for the first time, welcome to the original podcast entirely devoted to Star Wars role-playing, the Order 66 podcast. And I am joined tonight on the microphone and on Facebook Live by my co-host, a man of excellent hairstyles, Mr. GM Phil. Hey, dude.
I do what I can with what I got to work with, my friends. How are you, Mr. Chris?
I'm good, man. It's been kind of a weird weekend.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we launched this Kickstarter. We'll talk about it.
Yes, indeed.
So it's been a little unusual, that's for sure. But yeah, man, how have you been?
Been doing all right. I spent the entire weekend down in Rhode Island at a convention called Intercon, which is a live-action role-playing game convention. Basically think of Gen Con, except it's all like live action stuff. Sometimes theater LARPs, sometimes buffer combat LARPs. It was pretty fun. It was a pretty good time. First time I've ever been. Bunch of my friends go year after year after year. So this is the first time I said, eh, what the heck, why not? I'll go down. And had a pretty good time.
So why did you say, like, bring in a point to say it's a live action role playing convention? Like, you're assuming the listeners on this show have no idea what a LARP is?
Well, this is, to some point, you know, it's just mostly just to clarify that it was, in fact, a LARP weekend, not something where there's, like, tabletop role-playing going on. And, of course, you know, just so that, you know, you can give me crap.
Of course. I will never give you crap for LARPing.
Not for giving me crap for LARPing. Give me crap for pointing it out.
Okay, yeah. Well, I just need excuses to give you crap. It's all good. You know, I got the Patriots arrest record. That's all I really need to ever give you credit.
Oh, Robbie. Oh, man. You know, I bet you the NFL is somehow going to get a 2 or 3 game suspension on Brady out of this somehow.
Yeah.
They'll find a way.
But it's well deserved, regardless. Yeah. I stepped in dog poo yesterday morning. Suspension for Brady. Sorry. just deserving. Sorry. Anyway.
The trials and tribulations of a New England sports fan.
Yeah, well, you see me crying these big fat tears over here? Yeah, do you see him? You see him?
No, there's too much glare from the monitor. I can't, you know.
Oh, that must be it. That's why you can't see him. It's just too much monitor glare.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, fine. All right. Well, we have an interesting show. Very excited about this topic. I've been jonesing about this for 2 weeks, man, and really thinking about it. Something really fun, probably one of the most favorite things I love to do in this system, in any system for that matter, that we're going to be really talking about tonight and diving into. So you want to get this pig kicked?
Let's kick it up.
Let's do announcements.
Hello there.
What have we here?
Good news.
What do we got, man?
Featured podcast of the week. We geeks love us some movies. and we scratch that itch on the Movie Defenders podcast, which is devoted to taking the films most people rail against and exploring all the positive, great qualities they have and why we should enjoy them. The Movie Defenders recently released their 37th episode in a row to cover one of their most requested films to date, Venom. It's a great show that will have you clapping along as you listen or screaming into your speakers. Either way, it is going to be a great time. You can find that and many more great podcasts at www.d20radio.com.
Oh man, Movie Defenders, they're just too optimistic. They're too nice. It's too much positivity, Phil.
It's an admirable take on it, you know, defend the movies that people slam.
Well, whatever it is, I do enjoy it. And as Phil said, you guys can find it at d20radio.com. And while you're pursuing some great podcast goodness there, you will also find at d20radio.com one of the best blogs for fan-generated content and articles out there covering a variety of tabletop games and systems. In fact, we are proud to announce that the Kamino Science Directorate has just made d20radio.com a mandatory part of all rapid conditioning learning protocols for new clone batches. Woohoo! For us normies, you just have to make do with regular readings of new content every single day. And some big highlights from this week, the mighty Dave Brown brought us part 6 in his review series on 4th edition Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying, with a detailed discussion and analysis of the wounds, criticals, and condition systems in the game, and how the fate and fortune, resilience, and resolve mechanics come into play. Really good read for those who want to learn more about Wifrip 4th. Also, the inestimable Chris Hunt graces us yet again with more juicy stats in his HoloNet Uplink series, this time with the Walker Ace. Really cool stat block, a rival stat for an excellent Walker pilot. Whether they're driving AT-STs or AT-ATs for the Empire or the First Order or the Republic or the Resistance, this is a really well-made, well-crafted threat for some wicked encounters that you can put on your table tonight. And you guys can find this and more great articles with brand new content daily over at www.d20radio.com.
Convention madness time. Gamer Nation Con 6 is less than 6 weeks away. And event submission is live, as is the ability to purchase one of our few remaining tickets. You can head on over to GamerNationCon.com and click the event submission guide for the link to submit events and buy a badge if you haven't already, and assuming there are still any left. I finally got my first round of events up for waiting to get approval, and hopefully we'll have a couple more before the registration period starts.
Yes. Registration period is going to start in a couple weeks, so we've got a little bit of time.
Cool.
But even after it starts, we'll still take new submissions as they come, so very excited.
Nice.
Dude, shall we move to the shameless self-promotion corner?
Might as well, yes.
Should we call it the shameless self-promotion Kickstarter corner?
the word fits. It fits.
Okay, so for the Kickstarter for Gamer Nation Con 6, so Phil, set your Wayback Machine to 2002. 17 years ago, a dude named Michael Sullivan creates this little online RPG. It's 3 pages long. It's really rules light. It's called Everyone is John. It's a competitive RPG where every player is the voice inside of one man's head, and that man's name is John. It's a game that's played with a single D6 and scratch paper. And it's an absolute riot, even better when you're drunk. And set the Wayback Machine to about 10 years ago. GM Chris gets introduced to this game at a convention. And it's a riot, and we absolutely love it. And this game gets whispered about and talked about and passed around. So approximately 2 years ago, we liked this game so much, we played so many hundreds of hours of it, we decided to revamp it, enhance it. Make it awesome. Add a whole bunch of new content. Really make the rules a little better, a little more balanced, a little cleaner. We reach out to Michael Sullivan and say, hey, dude, we think you have an awesome idea here. We really want to do something cool with it. You want to work with us on it? And he says, my God, I don't have the bandwidth. But, you know, I released the game under Creative Commons, so you guys can do whatever the hell you want with it. Have fun and good luck! So for a couple years, with the aforementioned blessing of Mr. Sullivan, myself and Dave have been turning this little three-page RPG into a new edition that is about 50 pages long. And we decided to release it as free content for the Gamer Nation Con 6 backers. But we liked what we made so much that we wanted to make this game something we could all hold. We actually wanted to do a little print run for a book. And so we did. We did a little print run for the book. We just threw it on Kickstarter Friday. We just wanted to raise a few $100 just to do a very, very small print run and get some physical copies in our hands. And it's been an interesting 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why this has happened or how it's happened, but I'm flabbergasted that it's happened. Our little $500 Kickstarter is currently 3 days in, sitting at 1,190% of its goal. Has raised almost $6,000 with 332 backers who seem interested in this little game. Furthermore, we make an abridged digital version of the game with the core rules available for free the moment you back so that you can, you know, take a read, see if you like it, and, you know, we think you'll like it enough that you'll stick around for pledge fulfillment. That seems to be a pretty solid strategy because we're getting some pretty good feedback and comments on it. And we've hit all our stretch goals, one of which is adding a bunch of new adventure seeds to the book, one of which, Phil, I do believe you are gracing the pages with, if I'm not mistaken.
I am.
Have you decided yet? Are you going to give us a tease as to what your Everyone is John adventure seed is going to be?
I'm still trying to lock it down. One of the ideas I had was already taken. Another one of them is still kind of forming. So I'm still trying to come up with what I've got.
Well, it's going to be good. But what other, the people who have contributed to the writing for this book, especially Adventure Seeds, we've got D20 Radio regulars like Wayne Basta and Chris Hunt. We've got FFG freelancers like yourself, Ian Houlihan, GM Hooley, Keith Kappel, James Spawn. There's several others that are contributing. So we're very excited, and this is right up my alley, man. It's a great little quirky indie RPG, curiously unusual. A $5 pledge gets you the PDF if you missed the Gamer Nation Con Kickstarter. And a $10 pledge gets you a paperback copy of the book. So you can't go wrong with that. So what have I missed, man? I'm so unprepared to talk about this. I just was not expecting this Kickstarter to do anything.
You get character sheets that fit on in business card sized cards. You can get a hard copy cover. You obviously unlocked the hardcover version of the book.
We did. So,
folks can order like additional stacks of player character index cards.
That's true. They can.
It's solid. It's fun. It's a silly game that you can drop down and start playing in 5 minutes.
Well said. So this is it, guys. If you're interested and curious, head to Kickstarter.com. And do a search for Everyone is John, and you will pull it back. We'd love your support, because the more support we get, the more copies of this book we can get printed, and the more we can get it out there into the world. So I'm weirded out, floored, and very happy.
Now, one contributing factor to how I believe how successful this game was in such a short amount of time is that folks were able to stay in the know by following us on social media. You can follow us for news and podcast info on a daily basis, as well as occasional special projects such as this. You can like the Order 66 Podcast Facebook page for regular updates, to ask questions, and for the place to watch our unedited simulcasts of each show. And join the D20 Radio group for lively discussions. Mm-hmm. You can also follow the GMs on Twitter, at D20 Radio. And you can join our ever-growing and thriving D20 Radio Discord channel. We post and tweet info and announcements regularly.
Yes, we do. Yeah, man, there's been a lot of social media about this, I guess, hasn't there? So
yeah. There's been you have had amazing results.
Huh? It's the memes, isn't it?
It's totally the memes. It's utterly the memes.
People be loving memes. Also, those who are subscribed to our social media, I've gone to a meme announcement format for our shows, which I think people are enjoying. We'll be getting some pretty good feedback from that as well.
They are damn funny.
So, they're a lot of fun to make. So, yeah. Follow us on the social medias, guys. Well, all right, Phil, should we get into the Meet It Tonight show? Because we have a lot to talk about.
Dust off those shoes and don that fedora. Oh, it's time to go hunting.
Oh, brother. Let's do it. Okay, I could not come up with a decent title to tonight's meet, so I threw something on there that I'm not really happy with, but I guess we got it. And maybe as the show progresses, we'll come up with something better that can be an actual episode title for tonight. But what do we have, tentatively?
It was a dark and stormy night, or running investigations in your games.
So, like, Star Wars role-playing has many amazing themes and focal points set into the genre. Incredible action, hard character choices, a struggle between light and dark, hope against oppression, the fight of the underdog. I mean, these are all things for which I love Star Wars so much. But another common trope of Star Wars, and frankly, most role-playing games in general, is that of a mystery. Plucky heroes uncovering clues and motivations to a larger threat or an unknown challenge. Having player characters engage in such mysteries through investigations can be a great deal of fun at the table. Or it can be a slogging mess of railroading and utter frustration. And tonight, we're going to talk about the former and how to avoid the latter. How can you build investigations into your session? How can you build an entire session or multiple sessions around unraveling a mystery? How can you keep players engaged and keep them off the railroad tracks? Give them a feeling of accomplishment when they've solved everything. We're going to unravel all these mysteries tonight, and we're going to give you the best tools and tips that we can. So pull out those magnifying glasses, Gamer Nation, and as Phil said, don your fedoras, and maybe, Phil, your trench coats. Because the game is afoot, and it is a dark and stormy night as we uncover the clues to investigations in your games tonight on your Order 66 podcast.
So why investigations? What can adding investigations and mysteries bring to your games, and why should you consider it? Beyond that, what vibes, tones, and sources of inspiration can you draw from to bring into your game investigation? I want to preface this by saying that this is a subject that I was also very interested in talking about, because I feel that in my games, when I try to pull off investigations, I sometimes fall to some of these poor choices that we are going to talk about later today. So really looking forward to this discussion. But as far as Star Wars goes, Star Wars is not all about hack and slash. Any long-term player of the system knows the game is designed to do so much more than combat. Skillful characters, whether they're social, technical, scientific, or simply observant, they have so many options available to them than just hitting a guy with a stick or shooting someone with a gun. And when it's done right, a good investigation gives all players a chance to shine regardless of their character type or specialties.
Absolutely. You know, another important thing for me about investigations here is, more than anything else I've done in my own games, it's about engagement and it's about reward. The narrative dice system is one that, as we've talked about many times, Phil, it requires the players to engage in order to be successful, just in terms of playing with this system anyway and using the dice. Investigations and mysteries, they really take that engagement to a higher level in the story. Players, they love a good mystery to tease out. They just love it. And solving it provides a win at the table and a really good story to remember forever. Those stories they're going to talk about, you know, things that happened at the table years and years later, that those remember when stories. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And adding mystery and investigations to your sessions also brings in a much loved trope and theme to your games. Let's start with some of the classics. Noir. Groups are already inspired by films like The Maltese Falcon, Murder, My Sweet, or Kiss Me Deadly, can bring the gumshoe scene into their characters and their games. Perhaps your PCs are independent investigators, maybe hired by a third party or major political power to solve a mystery on the sly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or you could go more of a hard-boiled cop drama type. Fans such as fans of Hill Street Blues, The Wire, or CSI can get their law enforcement procedural groove on. Maybe the PCs are literal law enforcement in this game. Maybe they're normal people drawn into a larger conflict or mystery that affects them personally.
You know what I watched a lot of as a kid?
What's that?
I got my groove on with Angela Lansbury and some Murder, She Wrote.
It's a classic.
It's a classic. And honestly, I mean, that's another huge trope for this. Like, some of the most fun mystery themes come from these sources where the protagonists are, like, normal people or just professionals in some other field who find themselves by choice or by chance to regularly bring their investigation skills to bear. Dude, Murder, She Wrote, Columbo, Psych, Monk, dozens of other shows are great examples of really heavy mystery investigation, but in adventures with a decidedly more lighthearted or even humorous tone. When you compare that to something like Kiss Me Deadly or The Wire, okay?
Absolutely.
I don't know. So, I mean, even despite these hard-boiled or noirish themes that a mystery can present in a game or an investigation, you don't have to go that route. You can still keep it fairly light, which honestly fits with Star Wars extremely well, in, you know, depending on how your group likes to play and what themes they like to do.
Right on. Now, so if the GM is going to swing for the fences and add investigations to their game, just how should they do it? Or in some cases, such as mine, how shouldn't we do it?
Okay.
The first thing I think we have to consider is the investigation going to be an encounter or is it going to be a session? Mm-hmm. It is entirely reasonable to run an entire session based around an investigation or a mystery. In fact, you might find it that you have the most enjoyment and engagement from your players if you do so. But having said that, gotta put up with two things here. All the tips we'll give you mechanically running an investigation in your games are designed to work at the individual encounter level. And you can feel free to pepper such an encounter into any larger session that you're running. Just don't feel like you have to limit yourself here. Yes, you can totally take an investigation encounter and weave it into the larger plot for the session. And yes, you should also consider turning said investigation into an entire session. Both work, both are valid, and we're going to talk about both.
Absolutely. So, okay, if we're going to talk about both, let's start with the core, Phil. Let's start with the mechanics. Let's talk about making an investigation for an encounter. So,
sure.
You have a mystery for your players to solve, but to do that, they need to investigate. Now, whether this investigation is spread across one or more encounters, they need to search for clues, they need to unravel culprits, and they need to discover what others have failed to see. I think there are a couple methods that we can recommend that are kind of obvious in order to do this at an encounter level. What's the first and most obvious method?
And most obvious and one that a lot of folks probably default to is a single skill check.
Okay.
Just call for simple skill checks to uncover clues at the scene or to analyze them after the fact. All skill checks should center around the kind of clue you're wanting the PCs to discover or analyze.
Okay.
First one is physical evidence. For that, you might be able to get away with perception, maybe vigilance. Those are the most common skills for literally pulling out your magnifying glass, finding a piece of clue like a piece of torn fabric from a suspect's clothing, or a discarded murder weapon cleverly hidden, or a dossier of incriminating information in a crowded file room or office. Analyzing such a clue for meaning might involve knowledge education, knowledge underworld, or even knowledge warfare checks. Finally, maybe even social skills can be used to track down and speak to experts about the clue and what it means after it's been discovered. If you don't know what it is you've got, but you need to talk to some eccentric, aloof professor who would know its importance, sometimes you got to convince them that you knew they want to talk to you about the item in question.
Absolutely. Now, with physical evidence, this is Star Wars. Another huge common evidence type that your party is going to locate, potentially with these simple basic skill checks, is going to be electronic evidence or digital evidence. This is Star Wars. Information such as clues or incriminating evidence can often live on computer systems and in data paths. This leads to the computer skill, maybe skullduggery for breaking into said computers, to be the sort of de facto skills to locate that kind of evidence. You know, and then after you found it, you know, when it comes to analysis, additional computers checks could be used to then trace its meaning. Data such as photos, bills of sale, or digital paper trails might also lead to physical and social investigation checks, very similar to what you mentioned earlier, to kind of analyze their meaning as well.
Last point is social evidence. It's the last major category for clues. Eyewitness accounts, interviewing potential suspects for alibis, or possibly admission of suspicion. Skills like charm, coercion, and leadership are great when you're already identified someone but want to get accurate information out of them. Now, streetwise, somewhat peripherally linked, is perfect for canvassing a neighborhood or getting the word on the street about shady dealings or publicly known relationships that are clues to the mystery.
Absolutely.
You might not be able to get the hardcore evidence out of a streetwise check, but it might point you in the direction of where to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So,
I was about to say, okay, so that's one skill check. Boom, done, results. Mm-hmm. How, you have a way of putting that into something a lot more entertaining and interesting than just roll dice and then determine results from that one check, don't you?
Absolutely. And this is the ultimate piece of advice that I think we're going to give you guys tonight in regards to running an investigation successfully in an encounter. And that is the beloved skill challenge. Skill challenge, my skill challenge. Look, we've referenced skill challenges on the show before, and you guys can find examples of them in much of the free module content available in the Backer Zone section of d20radio.com. I even guessed it on a recent episode of the Dice Pool podcast, episode 19, which was a detailed talk about creating skill challenges. And honestly, we don't want to rehash all of that content here, but we are going to briefly talk about creating a skill challenge specifically for an investigation encounter and the best way you can go about doing it. Because skill challenges are, at least in my opinion, far superior to just a group of individual skill checks. For several reasons. One, it's going to ensure that the entire party is involved, regardless of their proficiencies. And two, it provides a mechanical framework that is fully transparent to both the GM and the PCs as to their levels of success and how close they are to failure. And as with anything else in this game, you know, from a metagame standpoint, the players need to know that. They want to know that. It's part of that engagement and action. So, skill challenges are the win for me. So let's talk about them.
All right. How to make a skilled challenge for investigation in two easy steps. Step one, figure out your core skills and their difficulty. Any skill can be used in a skill challenge, which is one of the biggest benefits of them. But a good GM will jot down 3 to 4 core skills with a core difficulty. These are the most transparently obvious and easiest skills for the skill challenge. For investigation encounters, it will depend on the type of clues they can find. Perception, streetwise, and computers are the most obvious choices, assuming there are all types of clues available. Physical evidence, digital evidence, and eyewitness evidence. Your core or easiest skills should have the easiest difficulty. Base should be about 2 purple on average, bumped up to 3 purple for more advanced parties. Also consider upgrading base difficulty once to include a red die, if the mere act of investigation is going to draw unwanted attention from interesting parties. Despair and threat can be used to create unforeseen encounters, removal or alteration of yet undiscovered evidence, and etc. And of course, on top of that, never forget the power of flipping a destiny point.
Always, 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 always. You know, for good skill challenges, man, I say you should default to 2 or 3 purple dice, but honestly, a good investigation should always have the threat of an interested party watching over you. A good investigation, you should always have the big bad be somewhat aware of your actions. So, honestly, your base should always have that upgrade to it, that red die, just in case. And then if you go off the rails and your party suggests a really interesting skill, at that point you're just increasing the difficulty by 1 or maybe tossing in a setback die or 2.
All right. So that's step 1.
Okay.
Step 2.
Step 2, and the final step, is to figure out the actual difficulty of the challenge. Now, this is not the difficulty of the skill checks in the challenge, it's the difficulty of the challenge itself. A skill challenge represents each PC suggesting a check and making it multiple times until the skill challenge is complete. But their success in that check and uncovering all the clues depends on hitting a total accumulated number of uncanceled successes on all of their checks before a set number of individually failed checks. Total successes and failed checks, how much work do you have to do and to succeed, and how easy it will be to fail, those two numbers are a little malleable. And in terms of investigations, a super easy skill challenge investigation, like super easy, would be 10 total successes before 5 failed checks, in my experience. A medium challenge, you're looking at 12 to 15 total successes before 3 failed checks. And a hard challenge is going to be 15 to 20 total successes before 3 failed checks. And I mean, you can mix and match to your heart's content in terms of number of total successes versus failed checks. If there's a ton of evidence to find, or it's very cleverly hidden, then bump up the total successes that you need. If the team has very limited time on site, perhaps before proper law enforcement shows up, or the clues are going to, quickly become contaminated, then lower the number of failed checks to fail the challenge. You've really got two numbers to play with and think about when it comes to any investigation encounter. How difficult is it going to be to find the clues, and how easy is it going to be to not find the clues? Those are two very different things to think about that are related to the number of successes that you're going to have to totally accumulate versus the number of failed skill checks that are going to make you fail out of the encounter.
Now, this kind of setup here for the skill challenge, it's intended to be a full encounter in its own right. And like any encounter, they can succeed or they can fail. Success in the skill challenge means that they find or analyze all the clues available. Every 3 to 5 successes should uncover a clue. Failure means that the challenge that they're forced to leave before they've discovered everything, or their efforts are simply didn't uncover all the clues, or they didn't properly analyze the clues that they found. Mm-hmm. Now, keep that in mind when you're looking at stuff that lasts for an encounter, even if they're going from kind of one scene to another, maybe back to the lab, or going off to talk to somebody else. It should be considered one encounter for the purposes of anything that involves that encounter, such as strain recovery, once per encounter skills, anything like that.
Absolutely. And, as another point, when we talk about, for investigation encounters and skill challenges, that de facto list of kind of, if you have all avenues of evidence available to you, having, perception and computers and streetwise, you're going to want to tailor what those core easiest skills are per investigation and what kind of evidence is available to you. Sometimes that list could include knowledge skills, okay? Sometimes if you have direct eyewitnesses, it may include charm or coercion, okay? Maybe if you've caught somebody. But you really want to tailor it ahead of time. And always with a skill challenge, allow them to suggest any skill check. Just adjust the difficulty accordingly. So, okay, Phil. Having laid this out now for an encounter-based skill challenge that can be thrown anywhere, let's talk about making a mystery at the session level.
Because sure.
Now that we have this mechanical understanding in place, let's rise a bit higher. Let's talk about building an entire mystery the session is designed around. Because it doesn't matter if your mechanics for running an investigation are super tight, if the mystery behind it sucks. Now, what do I mean here? I mean that there are several tips and tricks to weaving an overall mystery into a full session that should be embraced, both about doing it right and doing it wrong. So let's talk about that. What are some of our tips and tricks here for making this a larger mystery?
Well, the first one is that investigations are almost always part of a larger mystery. So developing your mystery is a very important pre-game factor. A hidden truth or complex answer the party is moving towards. In fact, most great games have a mystery to solve, whether the GM intended that or not. There's always an unknown story or reason for the enemy to be doing what they're doing. The hardest part, arguably, about building a gumshoe noir story is developing this mystery, and most importantly, getting your players' buy-in and fascination to the mystery.
Absolutely.
The best mystery stories will leave your players anxious for the next encounter so that they can see what happens next. The worst mystery stories are ones that are too simple. They're the ones that are way too complex. And this might be the single biggest mistake that GMs make, and we make it a lot when trying to do mysteries and investigations. Because in the GM's mind, the mystery is perfectly clear, because we wrote it. But in the players, it's an indecipherable web of people and minute events that's frustrating to come to any conclusion about, much less comprehend. And I gotta tell you, I've been on both sides of the GM screen in that scenario. The GM is just sitting on the other side of the screen with this look on their face and going, why aren't you picking up all the clues that I'm putting down and putting them all together? This is why the best remembered mysteries aren't so much about what's really going on as much as who's really doing it. The motivation is simple. The challenge and mystery is figuring out who is the one who's pulling the strings.
And that leads to the other important factor for any mystery you're going to develop. If you have a crime that's being solved or an antagonist in play of some kind, you've got to think about villainous motivation. All antagonists in your mystery have a reason for doing what they do. It's just as important to develop as the trail of clues is the why the antagonist has, because it will inform all of the clues that you're going to develop for your party to find. But interestingly, in both Star Wars and, frankly, in any good RPG mysteries, all for the reasons we've mentioned above, the best motivations tend to be very simple. Remember that. Simple motivators, all right? Let's talk about those motivators, because these matter. Why is the...
Greed!
Why is the villainous person doing what they're doing? And number one is greed. It's one of the most basic of human desires, motivations for outrageous actions, and the linchpin for many of the best mysteries. Villains don't commit evil actions because they're evil, but because they're greedy a lot of the time. They're filthy, corrupting greed, okay? Often it's greed for money or power. Sometimes it's greed for something priceless. Okay, this is a great, great fantastical space opera trope as well. Very common in fantasy settings as well as really good space opera. The idea of an eccentric collector who will stop at nothing to get his hands on that piece. You know that, you know what I'm talking about, Phil? That glossy-eyed look at it. You know, my precious.
I shall steal the Mona Lisa. Why? To sell it? Heavens no. Heavens. I want it in my den.
I want it in my collection. I must have it. All right. That level of almost unrealistic, you know, glassy-eyed fascination is something you rarely find in the real world, but it works. It's in fictional characters. It's a brilliant greed motivation. So consider that. Greed is a fantastic motivation for your villain to have kicked off whatever they've done to start this mystery. What else?
Well, the clean side of the greed coin is a need to simply protect a secret. The antagonist of the story committed murder or stole the MacGuffin not to gain something, but to keep from losing something. It could be freedom. Maybe the antagonist is hiding a criminal past or an act that would land them in jail. Could be ridicule or loss of position. Maybe the secret is one that would cost a powerful person in the normal world their station or respect, or would cost them their fame. A senator with a dirty secret who silences the person who knows it, for example.
Okay, so you talked about it a minute ago. Another huge motivation, especially in Star Wars, extremely common for villainous motivation, is the MacGuffin.
Get the thing.
Now, for those struggling to know just what it was, I mean when I say that and what Phil meant when he said it earlier, the MacGuffin is a term. It is used in cinema and storytelling, and it was actually popularized, interestingly, by Alfred Hitchcock. He actually coined the term the MacGuffin. And the MacGuffin is the plot device. It's the motivator, the item or the thing, the so what that drives the mystery at its inception. This could be an object. It could also be a person or a piece of secret knowledge, even. The classic and titular Maltese Falcon, the meaning of the word rosebud in Citizen Kane, the briefcase in Pulp Fiction, the rare element unobtainium in Avatar. actually, in an interview a while back, George Lucas himself actually clearly stated that R2-D2 is the MacGuffin, that he wrote R2-D2 to be the MacGuffin in Episode 4. It's the thing that everyone is after, okay, for obvious reasons. But the important thing, though, about a MacGuffin is that it drives the story but it becomes practically irrelevant in most cases towards the end of the story. It is the driver, not the resolution. Okay? And if you think of all those examples I gave you, the MacGuffin is completely irrelevant by the end of the story. The MacGuffin has driven the action that's led towards a completely different conflict. Okay? Such as, okay, we're now going to go blow up the Death Star. You know, so yeah, these are all the very interesting motivations. And you guys, you've got to come up with your villainous motivation first before you even think about building the mystery into your session and developing those appropriate clues and aspects for it. So how do we build the mystery into the session now that it's time, now that we've decided our villainous motivation?
Well, once you've got your motivations in place, it's time to craft it and the clues into a larger session plan. A good all-mystery session has several reliable session beats that we can recommend. A proper beginning, a middle, and an end.
Okay.
So we'll start at the beginning. Set the stage in the first act of your session story is key to engaging your players, holding their interest, and getting buy-in for the mystery. So, Chris, how do we do that?
Well, there's several methods, things you can do in a first act in the beginning to get that engagement. My personal favorite is shock and awe. Really good mysteries usually start with a despicable act. Whether the heroes are hired to investigate it or they're drawn into the struggle because friends and family were affected. Murder, theft, kidnapping. You know, the heroes might be hired or tasked with the investigation. They might start off by only being indirectly involved. Maybe they were hired for the job and they don't understand the full ramifications until the story progresses. A la Lethal Weapon. I love Lethal Weapon. Great example of this. You know, you start off with shock and awe. It's a suicide, a really nasty one. It's actually one of the first scenes in the film. But then as it progresses, it turns into a murder mystery surrounding a drug smuggling ring, you know, that the protagonists are completely unaware of when the shock and awe moment happens. Maybe an old associate or a family member, maybe somebody who owes you a favor or you owe them a favor, was murdered or is being hunted and comes to you for help. You know, all these avenues as a way to sort of shock the players into immediate engagement with some sort of despicable act.
Right.
What other avenues are there in the first act?
We just talked about it. The MacGuffin.
Okay.
The first act is when you introduce the MacGuffin, whatever it is, if there is one. You set the stage for the party and let them know what the goal is. Lead them to believe that the MacGuffin is what's important and what their goal is going to be. A stolen artifact is a classic example, often with the despicable act precipitating the theft or loss of the MacGuffin. What is it? What does it do? Maybe it appears to be an unremarkable thing. Why would someone want to steal it? Then the mystery resolves around that question. Mm-hmm. It could be an indecipherable message. Someone has died and left a clue about their death that makes no sense. You know, oh, Rosebud. Could be a coded letter on a strange map. The goal of the mystery, then, is to solve the riddle of what this message it means. And, of course, a person can also be the MacGuffin, especially when that person has been kidnapped as the focal point of the crime. Why were they abducted? What do they know?
And so, yeah, well, the last aspect potentially to bring into a first act is the clues themselves. Clues, clues, clues.
Yep.
Don't wait. The first clues for the party should be introduced in the very first act. The MacGuffin itself might be a clue, but usually investigation efforts on the part of the PCs need to uncover those kinds of things. You know, strange notes or items, physical or tactile objects uncovered from the scene of a crime or from the victim's domicile. These type of clues should provide hints as to how to proceed. And as the GM, when you're developing this, you want to think about, based on the villainous motivation and the crime that was committed, what are the reasonable clues that could have been left behind? Suspicious persons or witnesses, somebody who might have witnessed the event or odd things happening before or after, but whatever information they provide should usually contradict what is established as known, such as the official story from the police. Another great tip we can give you when it comes to clues. In order to really get your PCs invested in any clue they find, make it contradict what the official story is or what everyone else is saying. Because at that point, they've succeeded on checks or a skill challenge. They know something to be true. Everyone else says it's not. You're going to see engagement out of your players immediately just because of the fact they're going to say, no, that's not correct at all. And if the world tells them they're wrong, they're going to get even more committed to solving the mystery at that point. The state of the victim or the crime scene is another huge avenue in order to bring clues in that are really going to question the status quo and engage your PCs. If your despicable act is a murder, then something isn't quite right with the body. All right. He's been shot by blaster fire, but when you take a peek at the body, you find stab wounds. Okay. The body was found in a dark back alley on Coruscant, but his clothing and his hair are drenched in water. Okay. Makes no sense. Okay. And maybe the authorities, they want a quick cleanup. They're not interested in dealing with it. Just a mugging. Okay. No, something's not right here. But you have the clue contradict the primary narrative. But all these avenues are great ways to really kick off the story and build that engagement. Introduce the MacGuffin, throw in the despicable act, shock and awe them, and lastly, give them clues that are going to engage them by putting them at odds with the status quo, whatever that is. What about the middle?
So, good investigation stories are all about the twist, or sometimes several of them. And the middle is where you put that in. Second act is where these complexities start to show up. It's not terribly complex to accomplish this. But the bottom line is that the investigation reveals things that are contradictory at first and just don't seem to fit with a simple solution or the understood series of events. Mm-hmm. First of which is being a murder most confusing. Mm-hmm. Often, as we've said, a murder is the crux of an investigation, and the heroes are trying to figure out who is the culprit. But if this is the case, a good mystery on the table should start to have the PCs question why such a murder was committed, or perhaps the question established how. If the body was marked with gang graffiti, the party tracks the gang down, only to discover they have no idea who the victim is, or worse yet, loved the guy. He was a trusted friend. Or the victim, but his body is soaking wet. Why? The party is hired by the wife to investigate a murder when the police claim suicide. But investigation reveals suicide was actually likely, but the victim had no motive. He was too happy. He was content. What did he discover that led him to kill himself?
It's people! Soylent Green is people!
What's next?
Well, no, I got to comment on that. I really like that concept and that idea because, you know, this is another classic investigative trope and one that will shock your players. Suicide that they're convinced is murder, but turns out to actually be suicide. But then the guy killed himself because he discovered something absolutely horrific. All right. And then the mystery changes about them discovering what that is as well. Totally cool. Totally cool. Okay. What else in the second act? Dude, some rough and tumble. It's not just all about sweet skill checks. I mean, even if you're going to expand a mystery into a full session, you got to have some rough and tumble in there. There's got to be some action. But the action has to advance the mystery or provide additional clues by nature of the action. So what do I mean by that? The heroes are suddenly attacked or ambushed by goons that are intent on killing them. After the fight, who are these people? Who do they work for, and what are they trying to stop us from finding out? The best time, honestly, to throw this at your heroes is when they least expect it. If they expect to be ambushed when they go to talk to a suspect or go to interrogate the nearby gang leader, that's not when you should ambush them or attack them. Throw the ambush at them when they're investigating the victim's workplace, when they're walking to their car. Okay, it should be completely unexpected in order to add to the mystery. The point here, though, is that the goons' motivations are to stop the heroes from finding something they didn't know was important. And that in and of itself is the clue, okay? I'm investigating the murder of a guy who was rallying local gang leaders and riling them up, trying to have some kind of inner-city youth center he was developing. Oh my gosh, it's got to be the gangs that go do this. So we go investigate the local gang leaders. They probably killed him. And then we get attacked by, like, corporate sector authority thugs or imperial special forces. Okay, why the hell are they gay? And that engenders an entirely new mystery. Okay, this guy obviously wasn't killed by the gangs. He was killed by whoever just attacked us, or whoever just attacked us has a vested interest in stopping us. Why? Okay. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes, it does. So, Chris, you know what's better than one vile act?
Two vile acts?
Or more.
Ah, more vile acts. Yes, yes. That's in the show notes. I should have looked at the show notes. I should see. So it's what I get.
Well, no, two is more.
Two is more. Yes, yes.
So, yeah, another classic trope of the second act is the continuation of the shocked and awe from the first act in new ways. The police liaison the party has been working with on the case turns up murdered. In fact, they, the PCs, find him murdered. The establishment could even blame the PCs for the murder.
That never happens in a movie.
Was the contact... Oh, never. 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 Maybe the contract was murdered because he himself found out too much. Or is the bad guy setting up the party to get them out of the way? Mm-hmm. Could be that the person who hired the PCs in the first place shows up dead or kidnapped. The wife who believes her husband's death was no suicide suddenly turns up missing. And a classic fallback that I frequently utilize, massive explosions. PCs return to their base of operation, or hotel, or police station, only to watch and blow up in front of them. Authorities say the bomb detonated early.
Someone's trying to kill us.
It happens all the time. Guys are walking towards the building explodes, and the heroes go flying back 30 feet in the air.
Absolutely.
Stand up, brush off their dust on their jackets, because you know that when I go sailing 30 feet through the air, that's all I have to do. And continue on with the mystery.
Well, that's the thing. You know, this second act is so vital to continuing on with the mystery. And these options we're giving you of providing confusing aspects to the crime, bringing in some rough and tumble action that's going to bring in more unanswered questions, bringing in more vile acts that are going to escalate the situation even further. The last one we can really give you for the second act is really ultimately what all three of these things will accomplish that we've said so far, and that is personal commitment. And this is the ultimate goal you should take away from the second act of any good murder session, or mystery session, excuse me. The second act is when the party finally becomes a fully committed part of the drama. If they were indirectly involved before, they are committed now. Something has happened to make them committed to the resolution, beyond the fact that they were hired for a job, or they're doing a favor for a friend, or whatever. And this comes back into that more vile act, or, you know, the explosions Phil mentions. These are all things that get the party angry, and they get them committed. You know, now a friend has been kidnapped or killed. Now the bad guy blew up your pad. Now you've been framed for a crime you didn't commit and you have to clear your names. These are all things that get you personally committed by the end of the second act. And that is the ultimate thing you want to achieve in the second act of a mystery session.
So naturally after the second act comes the final act. When the adventure finally closes, the heroes learn the truth, whatever it may be. The reason for the despicable act occurred, who did it, and in what manner. The who, how, and why are fully revealed at this point. Could be that it was a turncoat. It's very trite, but it works great. The good guy is really the bad guy. The wife who hired the party is the one who pulled the trigger. The cops are covering up the actions of a noble civic patron. The kind NPC who helped you in your investigation is the secret mastermind behind it all. The party may have been used to find the clues that could lead legitimate law enforcement to the answers. Now the clues can be eliminated along with the party. Or the party may have been manipulated to find the MacGuffin for the bad guys.
That's a very common trope if you're dealing with a MacGuffin in your mystery.
Yep.
So I like the turncoat. Yeah, it's trite, but it really works. Another good one for the end is a little more classic. The power player. The villain behind it all is someone in a great position of power, right? The PCs have the proof. They know the score. But the challenge is now in bringing it all to bear against such a powerful figure. This is extremely beneficial also if you have a party that really enjoys the action. You're peppering in mystery as a part of things, but you really want to close out Act 3 with very strong, especially in some cases, combat. Power player is a really good choice for your villain. You know, for the power player villain who operates in the social limelight, such as a celebrity or a politician, this could be some clever skill usage to find a way to publicly air their sins, okay? Now, for a criminal overlord or a military dictator or leader, maybe the PCs have to come up with a cunning battle plan to storm their fortified compound and bring them to justice. That's, you know, things to do. And, you know, the power player is what we would look to a television show or a movie and call bad writing, okay? Whereas Phil's suggestion of the turncoat is a little more solid writing. When it comes to a role-playing game, it's not that bad of an idea. Again, you don't want things to be too terribly complex, and sometimes your players just want a big bad they can go kick his ass. And
yeah,
now you know who he is, let's go do it.
Yep. And the last one is The Victim No More. It's another classic mystery conclusion that is that the victim wasn't really a victim. He's the mastermind behind everything, faking his own death or kidnapping to try to get someone else put away for it. Mm-hmm. Perhaps he used the PCs to deal with his rivals. Perhaps it's about skipping out on a debt or tax evasion or false insurance claims. Mm. Perhaps he's engineered the schemes of the PCs to discover the MacGuffin, which he now wants for himself. All these are great ways to use the original source of the mystery in the first place to suddenly not be the victim, but the mastermind behind it all.
So everything we've talked about up till now is how to successfully run an investigation encounter, how to put those encounters into a larger narrative in the session, and what those story beats are that you need to think about. To close out this conversation, Phil, let's talk about what you do wrong when you're doing these kinds of investigations or mysteries. I do think we have to cover a few major pitfalls that are common for any GM in running an investigation encounter or a mystery session. Big errors that may appear small, but you'll find a much better time for you and your group if you can just avoid them all together. So what are these errors that you should ultimately avoid?
Don't get too complex. We said this before and we're saying it again. The biggest mistake a GM makes is making their mystery or investigation too complex, too intricate. Sure, there's going to be a hidden motive or a secret mastermind, but the plot should be simple enough for a six-year-old to watch on TV and understand what's going on.
That's the barometer.
The Grand Chancellor is really a Sith Lord. The victim never really died. He was faking it. The museum owner who hired them really stole the artifact all along. Now, a mystery has a twist or two, but it shouldn't require quadratic equations to figure it out. Because while I know it's all easy and clear to you as the GM because you wrote it, it will not be clear for your players when they're playing. Role players do amazing things at the gaming table, like ignore the most obvious of hints and clues. Because they do. Because they're PCs. So if you're going to take a Byzantine web of investigative complexity, you're going to have a bad time, okay?
Okay, you're going to have a bad time. Dude, can we talk about this? I'm sorry. How many times have you seen this, though? In your career in this hobby, how many times have you sat across from a GM as a player and just not, like the GM's staring at you like you're idiots, and you guys just, like, it's just way too complex?
So often. So often. And it's to be fair, it's why we're talking about this in the first place.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I appreciate GMs, let's face it, I want to be one too, who comes up and crafts a good mystery and is excited by the chance for their PCs to figure it out. But they put the clues out there. They think they put out enough leads and enough pieces for you to put together the puzzle. But I'm going to be honest, that's not my forte. So me personally trying to fit together some pieces, the puzzle, trying to see, like, the, you know, see through, the figure it all out, that's not where my strengths are. Can I do it? Sure. But it's not my thing. And you know, I honestly see it a lot more in, just because of the situation, the more chances I have the PC, I see it more in a LARP situation where the game master puts all the pieces out, but, you know, there's another level of complexity there, and that's simply that some of the PCs hold on to the pieces and they don't even know it. So you don't have the full picture, so you can't solve the mystery. But it's one of the pitfalls, it's one of the downfalls. They make the story too complex, and all it leads to is a frustrated PC party.
I like the barometer of six-year-old explanation.
Yeah.
Think of your PCs as a group of six-year-olds at the table, in terms of their capability to comprehend a plot. It shouldn't get more complex than that. If you can't summarize the twist of your mystery in a way that is in one sentence, in a way a six-year-old can understand it, it's too complex. Now, having said that, Phil, there is the opposite side of that coin, which is the other pitfall to the second pitfall to avoid, which is let the players use their brains. However,
yeah, that's where it really gets complex. A but B.
And it is, in contrast to the advice above, you really have to balance that line, and it's not easy. You have to let the players use their brains to tease apart your not-too-complex mystery. Leaving the actual deduction or decoding to your party is something most players are actually really going to enjoy. So let them do it. But it just needs to be simple. So what does this mean? It means that skill checks, individually, or skill challenges, if you decide to use one, should be used to find or analyze a clue, not to make the connection as to what the clue means or how it relates to the story. Okay? You find a clue of a signed insurance policy, a life insurance policy for $1 million, and you analyze it and discover that the man's wife is his beneficiary. That should be enough of a clue in a murder investigation for a player, reasonably, to put the dots together. Okay?
Yep.
A check doesn't have to be made to say, do you realize that that's the connection? All right? Unless your players just aren't getting it. At which point, maybe then you could call for a check and give it to them. One of the things my wife often said when she was role-playing frequently, she liked to play social characters, but my wife does not have the social acumen of her social character. And she would often say, look, I can't talk as good as my character can, so I'm just going to make the role, okay? you know, and bottom line, though, is if your players can't make those kinds of logical deductions based off the evidence that you've provided them, that's probably a clue that your mystery is too complex.
Probably. Finally, and I want to call this out because Hooli asked about this probably about 40 minutes ago at this point.
Yeah.
Prepare for failure. Ask yourself, what will happen when the PCs fail their skill checks? When they fail their skill challenge? What happens when they can't uncover the clues? Or fail to put it all together? Is the session over? What happens? Things should proceed, but in a more dangerous or damaging pace. They lag behind in the investigation, say, by failing the skill challenge, then they are forced to endure another, or perhaps harder, investigation later on in the adventure. Another person gets murdered or kidnapped. The villain has more time to close up loose ends, but the investigation of that new crime is another chance to uncover the clues and unravel the mystery. The point is that you need to have a plan as a GM for when they fail their investigation encounters. How are you going to move the story forward? And here's a hint. With more consequences, that leads to more investigation and more action.
This is the biggest mistake. Even more so than making mysteries complex. It's the biggest mistake. And we've talked about this in similar veins on the show before, have we not? It's like when we talk about skill challenges or any type of social encounter or anything like that.
Any type of skill check.
Anything. What do you do if they fail? Does the story grind to a halt? Look, the way this system works, an investigation skill challenge or an investigation encounter, or I'm sorry, a social encounter or anything, it's just an encounter. And if you look at a combat encounter, what happens to the story if they fail the combat encounter. Failing a combat encounter doesn't mean death. That means we ran away, okay, 9 times out of 10. What happens? Okay? You typically have a plan for that in place. You need to have a plan for that in place for every single encounter. Every single one. So I'm very passionate about that. And nothing irks me more when I read a module and I don't see that accounted for.
Yeah, yeah. That's because you have to account for that in this game. I mean, a failed skill check, if you're trying to unlock a door to try to get through it to just, you know, advance the storyline, a failed check doesn't necessarily mean you don't unlock the door. It could mean that it takes you so long to unlock the door that it's cost you massive amounts of time or prevented you from being able to either cover your tracks or maybe collect the MacGuffin. Or, you know, you can't let a failed skill check stop the story. It has consequences, absolutely. But it can't grind the story to a halt, as you said. You have to have a plan of what to do when these things fail. Every skill check, every skill challenge, at the very least, you should be prepared to have notes down, okay, what happens if they fail? And that's it. You know, in the case of this investigation, what happens if they fail? The crimes continue. Your bosses get more upset because you can't stop this crime wave, this murder spree, this rampant theft that's occurring. More people get hurt. More people get missing. More things are stolen. Ramp it up. You know, whenever things start getting, you fail the skill check, things start getting dull, double the stakes, triple the stakes.
Absolutely.
So, there's our advice. And honestly, to be fair, in the course of doing this episode, there's a lot of advice that I'm taking to heart, too.
I was going to ask, man, because you were really passionate about this topic, because you mentioned that this was an area as a GM you really wanted to beef up. Has this discussion helped you at all? Has it given you more to think about, or some tips and tricks? Any final advice you could impart?
It has. It absolutely has given me more tips and tricks, and I'm leaning towards utilizing this information quite a bit in the City of Heroes adventure that I'm hopefully going to be running in 6 weeks at Gamer Nation Con. Because,
awesome.
Let's face it, superheroes aren't always about hack and slash and beating up bad guys and smashing robots. Sometimes the heroes also, the superheroes are frequently the folks who are unraveling mysteries.
Some of the best, most iconic, loved superheroes out there are known for their detective skills.
I mean, they are. I mean, they absolutely are.
The Dark Knight himself is often called the detective, or, you know, the greatest detective alive, basically. I mean,
yeah. World's greatest detective.
World's greatest detective.
Official moniker.
So
yeah, folks, go find your world's greatest detectives and go take these tips and tricks that we've given you and go show your PCs a fun investigative time.
Absolutely. Ah, good talk. Well, speaking of good talks, shall we move to maybe some listener mail?
Bring them on.
Let's do it.
He doesn't seem to take a hint, this guy.
I was beginning to wonder if you'd got my message.
Messages from the Edge.
Boy, am I glad to hear your voice.
I think it would be wise if you took advantage of my knowledge in this instance.
So welcome to Messages from the Edge, where we take the time to answer your game and rules questions about the system. How can you get us these questions? Easiest way is to join our social media communities, like so many other listeners, and post it up on the Order 66 Podcast Facebook page, or send us a message on our Discord channel. As always, you can travel, of course, to our forums, accessible from d20radio.com, and post it up. Or you can email your questions to us at GMChris, GMPhil, or GMDave at d20radio.com. And lastly, if you're brave enough, you can leave us a question via voicemail on the D20 Radio hotline at 262-D20-RADIO. That's 262-320-7234.
What's up first, my friend?
Okay, our first question tonight actually came in from Facebook, from Martha.
Martha!
And bless you, Martha. You actually have a different name on your profile, but in Martha's question, she actually ended up by saying, please ignore my Facebook name. This is Martha. And I'm like, okay, so we'll call you Martha. Why did you say that name? So,
because it was in the notes!
So Martha says, hi, Order 66.
Hi, Martha.
I have a good question. I have a question you may have been asked before, so if you could link me to some good resources. My group at the moment is very new to role-playing in general. So when they were making their characters, I had two who wanted to be faces. One character is a charmer, and the other is a politico. I'm really struggling to keep them from stepping on each other's toes when we play around, and to give them both the space to play. Do you have any ideas as to how I can manage having two very similar characters in the party while still making everyone feel like they're getting equal screen time? Sincerely, Martha. P.S. I never listen to the 066 podcast, nor do I nag my players to listen to their specialization episodes.
My recommendation is to kill one of them. No. Honestly, Martha, this is a great question. And while most experienced groups tend to minimize this duplication of major roles in the party, it is not uncommon to have a couple social savvy characters or a couple technically savvy characters. And there are good ways to ensure that both characters are going to get their due. Let's ask you this. Would you have the same concern if you had two warriors in the party? Or two snipers? Two swordsmen? Probably not. Because a combat encounter is the great equalizer that RPGs are designed to do well and give those characters, all of them, a chance to shine. One of the great things about this system is that all skillful characters can get a chance to shine. We highly recommend you check out the social combat options in the system, and hey, check out our own episode 6, where it was released realized before the social combat systems were codified in the books.
Yep.
Face characters can tag team and duke it out as a unit in social combat just as easily as combat characters can in a traditional combat encounter. Let's face it. Here's a great example of social characters. Emperor's New Clothes. The two tailors.
Yes.
Social characters riffing off each other, pulling it off together. A good lawyer team. Paired prosecutors, paired defendants, defenders working on the same side, asking the same questions, using similar tactics, but playing off each other's wins and losses and successes and failures. There's no reason that you can't have this charmer and this politico come at a situation from two different angles, even using the same skills. So, how do you give them their chance to shine? Give them social encounters and let them do their thing.
That's what you do. Interesting. Good advice.
So our next question also comes in via Facebook, this time from Simon David Splithead Emmett. Got a mechanics question. My players are on a mission to blow up and or disable a dam before it's finished. How do you work out the amount of explosives needed to or hits the dam might have if using ship-mounted weapons on it?
Oh, so you got to go find those damn explosives, huh?
Get to the damn cannons.
It's an interesting question. I guess it's one that makes total logical sense in almost every major role-playing game out there. And yeah, Simon, you will find statistics for explosives in numerous books, from the core rule books to the specialization books, and those stats are going to give you explosive damage and pierce and breach qualities, costs, rarities, all that. But the truth, Simon, is that absolutely none of that matters for blowing up a dam.
You might even say, just don't give a damn.
Yeah, there are no damn explosives that you need to worry about. You do, but what I mean is those stats are there for anti-personnel or anti-vehicle combat, where we have truly codified stats for things you're attacking or damaging. But for structural damage, something like this, I just kind of think you're thinking about it the wrong way. Like, Phil, what is the amount of explosives needed to destroy a dam?
Enough.
What is the armor and the wound threshold for a structure, such as a dam?
Enough to be destroyed by the correct amount of explosives.
Correct. Think of it this way. When you watch a film, Simon, you read a book or a comic, and the heroes are trying to blow something up, do you ever recall a time when the heroes failed in their task because they didn't have enough explosives with them. Of course you can't, because those things are all determined by the narrative of plot. The difficulty for the PCs shouldn't be in ensuring they have the right amount of explosives. The difficulty should be in planting them successfully. The difficulty might even be in how to locate them in the first place, but if they're successful in finding them, they should just immediately get what they need or have what they need to blow up the dam. You know, and if the bomb fails to take out the dam, it wasn't because there weren't enough explosives or they didn't buy enough. It was because the party failed their knowledge, education, or mechanics check to place them appropriately. The challenge in this kind of scenario or encounter is about locating that rare resource in terms of the damn explosives to begin with. And even then, once you have a source, you should be able to get what plot demands. The challenge is in getting the damn locale correct to plant those damn explosives in the first place and then get out before things go boom. The challenge is in making a valid mechanics check or other checks to place the damn explosives appropriately before discovery. Those are where the challenges lie. If your concern is about how much explosives should my party get, you're thinking about it wrong. They just need to find a check to get the explosives. At that point, have the fun of blowing up the dam. That's the encounter. That's where the action is. Everything else, it doesn't matter in my perspective. I don't know, Phil? Am I off base here?
No, I don't think you are. And let's do one final comparison to the real world. When you're using explosives to take out a building or a dam, you're not using enough to completely atomize the building with the explosive. You're using enough to compromise the load-bearing structures within that building, and you let the weight of it do the rest. In the case of a dam, one good charge at a key point, and the pressure and weight of the water against it will do the rest for you.
Absolutely. You know, he also talks about using ship-mounted weaponry, you know? Like, how many hits should it take?
Enough.
Make it a skill challenge.
You know,
a few strategic points, good shots at the right locale, and that dam's coming down, or any structure for that matter. You know, don't make it the amount of damage they deal with the weapon. Make it a number of successful attacks, okay? In key points, and adjust the difficulty appropriately.
You know, if you're trying to take out a dam with a ship weapon, I would say that, you know, you maybe you say, okay, the weapon that's hitting it has to be dealing at least this much damage as a base. Like, okay, any weapon that has a damage rating of 5 or less isn't going to be enough to damage this dam. But as long as it's doing at least 6 points of damage, it's going to deal it potential enough to weaken the structure.
Yeah.
So like, X-Wing's lasers, their base damage is 6. It's good enough. So those lasers can hit it, and then it's a skill challenge, like you say. You need 10 successes. You need to score 10 successes against this target to damage it enough to bring it down. And every time you fail, the enemy squadron gets closer.
Yes. Yeah. And also keep in mind when it comes to Starship, the 10-to-1 rule. So if you're talking about Starship-mounted weaponry, if it deals 6 damage, that's 60 points of personal scale damage. Keep that in mind when you're thinking about the amount of damage that a Starship weapon can do to a structure or a building in the first place. It's practical explosives at that point. And if it's got a breach of 1, I don't care if it does 4 damage, or 3, or 2, or 1.
Oh, yeah. If it has breach, that's off the table. Now it automatically will deal enough to weaken the structure.
Exactly, because breach 1 equates to 10 points of armor, of ignoring 10 points of soak, all right? So I don't care what structure it has, what it is, that structure does not have 10 points of soak. Doesn't happen.
Even if it does, I mean, you're talking about literally at this point an armor-piercing weapon.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it's designed to make things explode. So, yeah, again, it's not about the amount of hits. It's not about the amount of explosives. It's about getting the right equipment, such as the Starship weapon, with the appropriate damage rating or breach rating, or just getting a high-powered explosive. Don't worry about how much to buy. Don't worry about how much they do. Just make the appropriate skill checks. Have fun. Get to the action. Yeah. So, I hope that answer helps, Simon. Good questions. And again, if you guys have questions for the Order 66 podcast, we would love to get them on the show. So, and now we're coming to the end of our broadcast, and time to talk about that next show. It's kind of a weird month coming up.
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff going on all over the place, don't we?
We do. So, guys, right now, we, and I do have to apologize for this, we have been, since the first of the year, we have been cadenced with a show every single 2 weeks. We're going to disrupt you just a little bit. Our next planned show is actually going to be Wednesday evening, March 6th.
So, 10 days.
Yeah, 10 days from now. Yeah, that's a really odd time, but I'm going to be in Europe March 9th through the 20th.
A little difficult to do the show there.
A little difficult. Which also means that after March 6th, it's going to be more than a couple weeks before I'm going to be back to do a show again.
So
we really wanted to get one in before I left, and I apologize for that, but it kind of is what it is. But, dude, we have we had a really fun discussion this episode, but next episode, we have something a lot of people have been asking for a very long time. Do you want to clue us in on what our topic's going to be next episode?
Companions! From the Hermit and the Pathfinder specializations to everyone who wants a droid. We're going to talk about how they work within the rules as written and what to do with any rules that are purposefully ambiguous on the subject.
It's very good. I'm really looking forward to that episode. It's going to be a lot of fun. So, guys, we want you to become a member of the Gamer Nation. Head to the Order 66 Podcast Facebook page, toss us a like, post up any questions or show topics you'd like discussed on the show. If you have any specific questions or avenues for next episode's topic of discussion and companions, post it up, let us know. If you got something from Messages from the Edge, let us know. You can also, of course, join the D20 Radio Facebook group, a very vibrant and active community of listeners ready to share your geeky love and passions and engage in robust gaming discussions. And of course, visit us at D20 Radio. Head to the forums if you wish to go old school and register and post up your mind. Email us again, GM Chris, GM Phil, or GM Dave at d20radio.com. Or if you're brave enough, leave us a question via voicemail on the D20 Radio hotline at 262-D20 Radio, 262-320-7234. Or just call and leave us a liner and tell us why you never listen to the Order 66 podcast. Thank you all for tuning in. This is GM Chris wishing you peace, love, and good gaming.
And this is GM Phil. May the dice be with you.
You've been listening to the Order 66 podcast, brought to you by Ethan Kinsey, GM Scott, Jeremy Bensley, Bert Ingley, Joshua Taylor, and William Thayer. This podcast and related websites are not affiliated with Fantasy Flight Games, 20th Century Fox, Walt Disney Corporation, or Lucasfilm Limited, and its content is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. All original content is the intellectual property of the Order 66 Podcast and Gamer Nation, LLC.